You are listening to Mind Over Matters here on KEXP at 90.3 FM Seattle. It is a minute past 8:31, and we are talking with none other than Jav Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, co-editors of Eat the State, the publication that's on the top of David Barsamian's reading list.
Yeah, apparently so, and particularly Maria. He seems to really like Maria's work quite a bit.
Yes, well, we all do,
but that's true.
Not the way you guys joke about it.
Even Maria. Well, you know we're joking, right?
I'm not sure sometimes. No, I'm just kidding.
No,
I mean, I know
David,
you guys are joking.
And interestingly enough, I mean, David has a long history with Eat the State. I think he was really one of the first sort of national alternative media folks who really picked up on Eat the State, like literally within a few months of when it started in 96, and got several other people around the country to subscribe to it. And he's been hawking it around the country for years. He's really a big fan. So. Mm-hmm. And, you know, keeps really careful tabs on alternative media efforts all around the country. He's really been very, very supportive in a lot of ways behind the scenes. So give him props for that.
Yoo-hoo. All right. Well, we got a lot to cover in a very little amount of time this morning. So one of those things was the current top guy in the administration.
Cheney?
Rumsfeld?
No, the...
It's not Powell.
No, the other one. The one who has
The one with the big ears, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, the one who pretends that he choked on a pretzel.
Well, you know, a bunch of people died last year, so can we kill something now? I mean, you know.
So he was speaking before the UN, and I don't know if you caught
any
of that.
Yes, he went to the UN to, quote, make the U.S.'s case for a war against Iraq. And the way it was played in the U.S. press is that Bush went to the U.N. and he made a speech, and it was well-received, and now the U.N. is on our side, et cetera, et cetera. In truth, this speech to the U.N. was a major climb down for Bush. Initially, he wanted to go to war. He wanted to build a coalition. When the coalition didn't emerge, he wanted to go to war unilaterally. And when his advisors said, well, gosh, we don't have the money, we don't have the ability to do it on our own,
Can't get the bases.
Yeah, we need some bases over there if we want to do a fast, quick one like Afghanistan. We can do it from aircraft carriers, but that's going to take months, if not a year or two, just to get them over there. And Bush doesn't want to do that. So he has to get a coalition together, and to do that, he obviously now has to go to the UN, and he did.
And that's going
to
cost money.
Oh, yeah. And right now, the real horse trading has begun. Which means in order to get countries like France, Russia, and China, the three permanent members of the UN Security Council that very heavily oppose a war against Iraq, in order to get them on the Bush administration's side, they're going to have to offer some big incentives.
Yeah, which is how it's done. I mean, with any of these countries, it's not like they have any kind of respect for human life or anything, but they want something out of the deal before they're going to sign off on it.
That's right. And I mean, they did a lot of posturing in the weeks prior to this speech in order to get Bush to come to the UN and play by the rules. And now that he is...
And drive up the price.
right, exactly. And some commentators have said that that's what they think, especially the French president could be doing now. And Russia in particular. I just wanted to go down the list of what the U.S. is going to be offering some of these three countries in order to get them to buy on to not just a war in Iraq, but also just resolutions at the U.N. That would set a deadline for Iraq to comply with weapons inspections, which is the minimum that has to be done before the bombing begins. France, for instance, wants access to the oil fields in Iraq after the war. They would want to ensure that they would have some kind of access, since they feel that they were shut out the first time around. They also may want other economic or trade-related concessions related to the EU and the United States. There's been a long-running trade war between the two. China, excuse me, is just starting to do business in Iraq, and it would like to have those economic interests protected. They'd also like to expand access to the Iraqi market. Iraq is a very heavily populated country. China is also concerned about the Bush administration's support for Taiwan over mainland China. That's a reversal of the Clinton administration policies, and China would like this reversed, so the U.S. could offer them that. The U.S., notably in the last couple of weeks, the U.S. just reversed its course and granted support for China's repression of a Muslim separatist group in northwest China. The U.S., the Bush administration, just added it, the East Turkestan Islamic Movement, to the State Department's list of terrorist groups and supported China in requesting that it be allowed, that it be added to the U.N.'s list of terrorist groups.
Yeah. And by the way, the U.S. could have done the same thing with Russia in terms of supporting and offering military support for the war in Chechnya, except we already did that in order to get Russia's support for Afghanistan.
Right. There are other things that we can offer Russia. Russia's a long-time business partner with Iraq. Iraq is very close to the Russian border. It doesn't share a border with Russia, but it's not very far away. Iraq owes the Russian government $8 billion in debt that it has not been able to pay since the first Gulf War, and Russia would like to ensure that Iraq eventually be able to pay that debt. Russia also is just in the process of negotiating a $40 billion economic cooperation pact with Iraq, and they'd like to protect that economic cooperation pact. Russia also would like access to Iraqi oil fields. This is a matter of control. It's not a matter of ensuring supply, since Russia has its own oil supply. But they also view Iraq as being within their sphere of influence. Russia would also like the U.S. to ignore a planned $1 billion nuclear power plant that they have just provided for Iran. Washington was kicking up a fuss about proliferation problems with this nuclear power plant in the past, but has just recently started to tone down its rhetoric, I think, trying to win Russia over to its side in a war against Iraq. And yes, there's continued support for a crackdown on Chechnya. Those are the other things that Russia would like from the U.S.
And by the way, this stuff is very, very reminiscent. This is exactly the sort of horse trading, and I mean, it's very similar to what little kids do with baseball cards, you know, little boys when they're 8, 9, 10 years old. But this is exactly the sort of deciding the fate of other people's lives and futures that used to go on in the mid and late 1800s around imperialist conquest.
Exactly.
of different colonies. That's what we're looking at again. It's not even just economic imperialism or cultural imperialism anymore. When people talk about redrawing the boundaries of countries in the Middle East, this is exactly the sort of precedent and thing that we're seeing reversion to. It's very, very troubling that nobody's putting it in that context.
Yes, and there are other nations that want things too. Turkey is going to be wanting some support, wanting us to forgive some of their debt and to provide them with some weapons and support in handling their Kurdish minority and ensuring that in the event of a war that there's not an independent Kurdistan created in that region. Which might take some territory away from Turkey. But there's a disconnect here. What the Bush administration wants is a quick, easy war with very few American casualties, which is going to mean a massive aerial bombing campaign and massive destruction of infrastructure. That's basically what the Bush administration is headed for. But what France, China, and Russia want is to ensure that a future Iraq will be able to pay off its debts and be able to continue economic agreements that these countries have with Iraq. Now, there's a disconnect there.
It means a lot of construction contracts for Brown and Root.
Oh, yeah. But it may also mean a little bit of reluctance on the part of these three countries to allow an aerial bombing campaign that's going to just level the infrastructure in Iraq. So there's still a bit of disconnect there. Even though there's horse trading going on, I can see a delay down the road between Bush wanting to start a bombing campaign before the elections and these three countries not really wanting a bombing campaign at all. So we'll see.
Yeah, I don't know that it's going to happen as quickly as the White House would like, particularly before the elections. at the same time, you know, the speech before the UN, and we saw it in U.S. media coverage, the audience was us. I mean, as with the entire propaganda campaign. And it was very interesting that in David Barsamian's talk last night, and we'll talk about Reclaim the Media going on today, but the presentation last night with he and Davey D and Amy Goodman, of course, and other folks was just phenomenal. He actually quoted and used the same quote from Hermann Göring that I have that we put in Eat the State this current issue, and that I also used to lead off the post 9/11 column that I did my Working for Change column on Thursday, talking about Bush's UN speech and what I think was just really his repulsive use of the deaths at the World Trade Center as a backdrop for prosecuting an unrelated war that would surely result in far more in the way of innocent civilians dying than died in Manhattan or all of the attacks last year combined on U.S. soil. Using the same quote, which was, the people can always be brought to do the bidding of the leaders. That's easy. All you have to do is tell them they're being attacked and denounce the pacifists for lack of patriotism. That column got picked up as a lead news story by Yahoo, and the hate mail started pouring in. Scores and scores of letters from outraged Bush supporters. In fact, the column that's up right now on Working for Change is some of those letters and my response to them. But it was very, very interesting amongst all of those letters to see the effectiveness that this propaganda campaign is having with people, repeating the same themes over and over again: evildoers, access of evil, weapons inspection. And, you know, we can sit here and talk about all the nuances of this and all the political realities behind what's going on and how this and that lie is being told, but it's not what most people in this country are hearing, and it's very, very disturbing. And one of the themes that's coming out in the media conference this weekend, both the NAB conference with the radio broadcasters in town, and the contrast with the alternative media folks that'll be over in Freeway Park today, is that any propaganda system depends on repetition. And you can get me onto Yahoo, you can get Maria being picked up in alternate, you can get Eat the State out in the community, we can have radio programs like this, but they're a drop in the bucket in terms of the overall media landscape, particularly once you get outside big liberal urban cities like Seattle. And that is a real problem, because the American public is the real audience for all of these speeches and all of this propaganda. It's our opinions that count as far as the Bush administration is really concerned. And, you know, ultimately, we're the only people who have the kind of leverage in terms of public opposition and concern to either stop or even slow down this war. And there is a tremendous amount of public opposition and public concern. And that's what the Bush administration is really, I think, quite frightened about right now, is that not everybody is automatically rallying. And that's what they're trying to whip up. And you know, it's a tremendous challenge to try and stop that, because they got a lot of resources to put that message out there.
Mm-hmm. Well, we could go on with this for a while, but we also have something coming up this week that we need to devote some time to.
Oh yes, the election.
Uh-huh. Well,
we should get to the inquest very briefly first, though.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, we said that they would both be whitewashes, and they were.
Mm-hmm.
So that we're
and that's now, right. That's right. In fact, I was shocked at how quickly it took them to come back with a verdict in the Sean Maxwell.
Yeah, it was astonishing. It was very, very quick. And then we had the dismissal of the juror in one of these cases because she was concerned that the police in their uniforms.
He was concerned.
He was concerned.
There were two black jurors on the panel, and one of them, the male juror, had been part of a conversation in which, or actually had overheard a conversation in which one of the white women on the jury had asked the security guard, why are there so many uniformed police officers in the courtroom? You know, why aren't they out doing their jobs? And he had replied, well, there'd been threats made against Mel Miller, the deputy who was on trial.
No, he was a lead witness. Just because he shot somebody doesn't mean he was on trial. We would never do that.
Right, right. And interestingly enough, the judge then took all of the jurors who had overheard this conversation aside and asked them questions about this and whether they felt comfortable with the situation. And the male black juror said that he felt the extra, up to, I guess, dozen at a time, uniformed police sitting in the audience during the inquest was an attempt to intimidate the jury or to influence the jury in some way. And the judge, instead of asking these policemen to leave their uniforms at home and to dress as civilians when they are off duty, she actually dismissed this juror, told him to go home, which I think is outrageous.
Yeah, but as we've said before, you know, over the past 30 years with these inquests, when a law enforcement officer has been involved in the death of a civilian in King County, with the way the inquest system is set up, out of about 150 different cases like this, not once has the law enforcement officer been found culpable. It's very hard when trying to foresee the outcome of these cases. And that's, you know, no matter what the circumstances were, or what the evidence was for or against any culpability. You know, those kind of odds, it's awfully hard to go against the track record when predicting the outcome of these, and that's exactly what happened with both of these cases.
Mm-hmm.
All right, let's move along. We have an election coming up this week, and you guys regularly do election issues
yeah.
Right before that?
Yes, we do. It's one of our most popular.
Uh-huh. They get grabbed up even faster than normal.
Yeah, and we even hoping to have it back on the website this year. Last year we had a little bit of a mix-up.
A little bit of a glitch, yeah.
But it should be. I actually didn't see it up on the website yesterday, but it should be up shortly,
I think. It takes some time for Peter to get around to putting it up.
Yeah, but it should be up shortly. But in any event, there is a primary coming up on Tuesday for folks who haven't already voted via absentee. There are some important races this year, particularly primaries in our area for the state legislature, because obviously within the city, especially it being heavily Democratic, there's very little meaningful opposition from Republicans or Libertarians or unfortunately the Greens. But there are also a number of judicial races, and those races in particular, people really, I think, appreciate what ETS does in terms of its recommendations, because there's so little information that's available on many of these races. And, you know, certainly from the voter's pamphlet, it's very hard to distinguish what some of these people are like. So I get, you know, running through these, and I can run through some of the ones that were put in ETS, and other people can chime in, because, you know, it's not necessarily a monolith in terms of how many of us feel on these things. But we do try and get some of the information out, starting with the races other than the legislature and other than the courts. There are a couple. The prosecuting attorney for King County, Norm Mailing, is up for re-election, and he is unopposed.
As usual.
And, you know, he's been doing this for many years. He's sort of a Rudolph Giuliani type figure, you know, trying to be a moderate Republican but tough on law enforcement and so forth, prosecuting, seeking a death penalty in a couple of cases right now. But, you know, no matter how bad or good somebody is, they shouldn't be unopposed in a democracy. Mm-hmm. I just don't think that's appropriate, even if it's a politician that I think is doing a wonderful job, which is, you know, not that frequent, but it can't happen. But you know, so in this particular case for ETS, we recommend that people write in James Ujamaa.
Also, remember, James Ujamaa is the Seattle man who's in indefinite detention by the FBI because he tried to start his own little tourist jihad ranch in Oregon.
So the Seattle Times has been trying their best to convict the man, but he has not been convicted of any crime yet. So he is still a registered voter and still very eligible to serve.
The evidence of his connections to Al-Qaeda are so slim that the people who are supposed to be his main connections to Al-Qaeda are still free and able to travel in Britain. So.
Yeah, it's one of these 6 degrees of separation sort of thing, mm-hmm. where probably half the people listening could be convicted on similar types of evidence. You know somebody who once met somebody who dined in the same restaurant, uh-huh. as kind of thing.
But yeah, so you know, write him in, James Ujamaa, Ujaama.
Yeah, it's it, and with any luck, uh-huh. he'll be our next prosecuting attorney, and you know, Norm Mailing will have to answer for some of his friends and some of the vacations that he's taken.
That's right.
So the other thing that is kicking in locally also is Dow Constantine, who is coming up for King County Council, and he's in West Seattle, and one of these sort of liberal Democrats who never really does much of anything. He just sort of gradually moves up the food chain. So that's another one where I would suggest that people either just skip it or, you know, write in somebody that they feel is appropriate. You know, whether it be, yeah, I suppose you could do Sean Maxwell, but he's dead.
He's not alive anymore.
Yeah, so
you could do Robert Thomas Jr.
Yeah, well, that's true. He's still alive for the time being.
That's true.
But you know, now that all those uniformed officers that were attending the inquest have free time on their hands, I suspect that Robert Thomas Jr. is taking a vacation of his own. but in any event, so moving along to the legislative races, the most hotly contested ones in Seattle. There are several. The 37th district, which is South Seattle, has been redrawn slightly in for this election. And there are a couple of competitive races on the state Senate side. You've got two progressives once again facing off against each other, Adam Klein and Don Mason. And these two really don't like each other. They fought a very, very bitter battle 4 years ago where Don gave up an extremely safe seat in the House of Representatives to try and unseat Adam Klein, who at the time was a relatively untested incumbent, untested in that he had only served part of a term. He had been appointed to fill the seat of somebody who had vacated. And Klein won that one. It was a very bitter battle. Don has gone on to continue to do very good activism work in the community. She ran for city council last year, did not survive the primary, and was not expected to run for any electoral office this year, and at the very last moment filed for Adam Klein's seat again. Last time around in this race, I endorsed Don Mason. This time I endorsed Adam Klein. Not everybody in the progressive community agrees with that. Both of them are very good. They agree on really 95% of the issues. They have somewhat different emphases in terms of what they do. And Don is trying to make the case that she should be elected instead of Klein because she has more of an emphasis on education issues, and that's very important in Olympia and such. I went with Klein in this one for this fairly simple reason that the things that he has been emphasizing in recent years, and particularly the last year, he had the Senate committee chairmanship that allowed him to bottle up Governor Gary Locke's efforts to vastly expand wiretap and surveillance powers and do a number of other things in quote-unquote anti-terror legislation last year. That almost certainly would have passed through the legislature in Olympia, except that Adam Klein bottled it up in the Senate side. He really single-handedly stopped that. Locke has said he's going to go back this year and try and do the same sorts of things again, tweak the legislation a little bit to address some people's concerns, but basically it'll be just as bad. And, you know, if Klein is not back there, if we elect Don Mason instead, she would not have that committee chairmanship. She wouldn't have the seniority. She'd be doing something else. And we could have vastly expanded law enforcement powers in this state. So, I mean, for that reason, if none other, even though I'm not an Adam Klein fan on some issues, I do think he should be reelected on that one. And that I think is really the toughest of these different ones in terms of an endorsement call. I can certainly see the other side. Some of the other ones that are out there, State Representative 37th, a very nasty hit piece by Eric Pettigrew, who is sort of Norm Rice's golden boy. There are three people. It's a three-way race against Angela Toussaint and Cheryl Chow. Cheryl, of course, is the former city council person who was a lapdog for business interests when she was on city council. She's awful. But Pettigrew
her only issue is education for one thing.
Yeah, but she's the daughter of Ruby Chow, who is a huge political force in Seattle, and yet she tries to pass herself off as this very humble upbringing and working class and a tenants' rights advocate, when her only endorsement last time when she tried to get on city council was the apartment owners. I mean, you know, she's very disingenuous. But Pettigrew put out a hit piece on her that many people may have gotten in the mail that was just nasty. Talking about allegations about her running an ad that did not list endorsements properly, people that didn't endorse her that she said. This was an incident that happened 5 years ago, and you had to search very hard in the mail piece to find that it happened 5 years ago, that it wasn't that big a deal, and that it was paid for by Pettigrew's campaign. That alone, along with, I mean, for that matter, also Pettigrew is very much of the Norm Rice business-friendly liberal ilk. But the third candidate in the race, Angela Toussaint, is really the best of the bunch anyway. She's a very seasoned, very effective community activist who's really done some wonderful things. So Angela Toussaint on that one, and anybody who sees all those endorsements for Eric Pettigrew, remember also that he's a shark. He's a very ambitious one, and he'll probably act that way when he gets to Olympia. The only other House of Reps race that we have time for right here would be the 32nd, where Marilyn Chase is the incumbent, facing a fairly stiff primary challenge from another Democrat named Kevin Grossman. And Marilyn is the president of the board of what was once Peace Action, now the Peace and Justice Alliance of Washington. And that group is going through its financial troubles right now. It's on a hiatus. But that is a measure of where her political sympathies lie. She's been a very active person in the community on peace and social justice issues for many years. She is the incumbent, but only because she was appointed about a year ago. So she doesn't have, you know, a lot of name recognition and community support, but I think it's important to put her back into Olympia. In terms of the judicial races, and this is the one, these are the ones where people really don't have a lot of the information sometimes. There are several important ones. The state Supreme Court is probably the ones that are least known and most important. There are a couple of those. Michael Spearman is the best for one. There are a couple people named Johnson running for the Supreme Court. One of them you should vote for, the other one you should not. Position number four, Charles Johnson, is the one you should vote for. He is very, very good. He's one of the best Supreme Court justices we have. He's been around for many years, done a pretty good job. In the other race, though, the one that Michael Spearman is in, and Spearman is a long time, he's on the King County Court right now, done great work with the drug court, mental health advocacy, things like that. Before that, he was a public defender that did a lot of work doing things, for example, with Mothers for Police Accountability, doing Know Your Rights type trainings and, mm-hmm. and things like that. But one of his opponents, and probably the one that has the most name recognition, is a guy named Jim Johnson. He is Tim Eymann's lawyer. He worked under Slade Gorton in the 70s and was really the force behind taking the Gorton's crusade against Native American fishing rights all the way to the Supreme Court.
He is
rabidly anti-Native American, very proud of that work, very vehement in terms of property rights, was the lawyer behind I-48, the property rights initiative a few years ago. You know, could be a libertarian concerned about civil liberties on the, when he gets on the Supreme Court. That's a lot of his rhetoric right now. Or he could be a flaming disaster, and Michael Spearman is just a much better choice. So be aware of the two Johnsons in that race.
Very good. We only have 2 minutes left.
Okay. Well, then, of the district court races, probably the most, and the other thing I want to mention, the district court one that is most important probably is Art Chapman is Rennie. Is that the one that? No, Chapman is very good. What's his name? Steve Gonzalez is very good, but Joseph Coleman is the race that you really want to pay attention to, because he is not only very good, but he is running against a woman named Jeanette Barrage. And for mm-hmm. folks who don't remember who she is, among other things, she was notorious for asking women lawyers in her court when she was on municipal court to wear skirts in court. Before that, she was known as the rabid property rights judge who really didn't have any qualifications. Served on municipal court for 4 years and is still considered unqualified by the local bar association. But now she's actually looking for a promotion, even though she lost her reelection bid a couple of years ago. She's now going for a higher court, for the district court. So she's running against Joseph Coleman. Vote for Joseph Coleman, and then do it again and tell your friends to do it too. And then the one other thing that it's on the ballot that's very important to support is the housing levy. It may be in trouble. Polling is very close. It's not ideal. You know, there have been some things coming out about moderate income people getting some of the housing. It's based on property taxes, which are regressive. But the bottom line is it creates 2,000 new housing units in Seattle, and we desperately need that. So vote yes on the housing levy.
So if people missed any of that, they can pick up a copy of Eat the State.
Yeah, or www.eatthestate.org. It's on the web. It's free around town. There'll be plenty of them down at Freeway Park today, where the Reclaim the Media conference is going on.
Listen, I'll be there at a table today,
yeah,
and so will our layout person, and so will Job.
Yeah, and you can even maybe sneak into the National Association of Broadcasters convention and steal some of their food. You know, the options are many.
Kind of hungry right now.
Yeah,
so
hear they've got a good breakfast.
You'll be down there pressing the flesh.
Yeah, we will
eat the broadcasters.
There you go.
Right. So then we'll be talking with you both next week.
We'll be back.
Yes.
All right. Talking, of course, with Job Parrish and Maria Tomchik, who are co-editors at Eat the State, and recommend everyone
Start heading on down to the Reclaim the Media event, which starts at 10 this morning.
Yes, and then create your own media after you get the skills this weekend.